Hello and welcome back to another episode of C-Suite Conversations with Scott Miller. That's me. I'm your host each week, where on Thursdays we release new episodes where we have phenomenal conversations with someone from the C-Suite. This podcast is a spin-off of what is now the world's largest weekly leadership podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller, which tapes twice weekly about 15 feet to my right in this studio. Both of these podcasts are audio and video, where we have great conversations with people that have had amazing journeys. The reason we developed the C-Suite Conversations podcast is after 6 years, we found that the most valuable episodes, as rated and ranked and downloaded by the listener and viewer, weren't always the Hollywood best-selling actor or the rocket scientist CEO that went to the moon, but people like you and me that had phenomenal careers that made it to the C-suite as a founder, as an owner, perhaps as an entrepreneur, or just someone that worked their way through a phenomenal career into the C-suite in a public or private company, but they've got a great story to tell about how they got there and what they're learning while they are there. Today's guest is Aisha Armstrong. She is the co-founder and CEO of Vectrus, and she's going to tell us today all about that company, her journey, and what they do to help their customers. Aisha, welcome to C-Suite Conversations.
Thank you, Scott. It's so good to be here.
First, did I slaughter the name of your company? Hopefully not.
No, you got it right, Vectrus.
Tell us a little about what that means, why that word, and what your mission is in that organization.
Yeah, so I co-founded Vectrus 6 years ago with my business partner to help B2B services companies do what we call productize, which is just a word for standardizing and usually tech-enabling services so that they can be sold in a more scalable fashion.
So, please keep going.
Well, we started as a consulting company, and the name Vectrus is something that we had to cook up over an afternoon so we could put it on the contract for our very first client, because they said that NewCo was not an appropriate name to put in front of their board for sign-off on the expenditure. So we had to go from NewCo to something else. And we chose Vectrus because it's a combination of the word vector, so motion in a direction, and then Eris, who's the Greek goddess of mischief and discord. And so our brand promise is to guide our clients through the inevitable chaos that comes with productization and new product innovation.
Doesn't every company wish they had the same story to describe the delight of their name formation? Okay, let's come back to productization and product management. You've had a remarkable career in education. Would you take a few minutes and reorient our listeners and viewers to your academic and professional journey?
Sure, yeah. So I started my career at a company at the time that was called the Advisory Board Company, headquartered in Washington, D.C., privately held company by David Bradley, where I did best practices, research, and data analysis for some of the world's largest corporations and financial service institutions. That company split in two, and I stayed with the part that became the Corporate Executive Board, or CEB, and gradually rose through the ranks at that company through its IPO and 10x-ing its size over a course of 15 years. During that time, they did sponsor me to go back to school and get my MBA at Harvard, which was a wonderful experience. And I was one of the youngest managing directors of the firm. And most of that time I spent in product management, product leadership, P&L ownership roles for a corporate finance practice. So working with CFOs, corporate controllers, treasurers of some of the world's largest organizations on their most pressing problems.
Phenomenal history. I have a lot of mutual friends you probably know from the corporate executive board, including Jennifer McCollum, who has been on our podcast before. Big fan of Jennifer and her recent book. Let's talk about what it means to productize technology or services and how that integrates with this art and science of product management. Give us a little masterclass on that.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, when we say productization, we're typically talking about standardizing and then using technology to more scalably deliver, in the case of our clients, their services. So Think of, for example, a law firm, an accounting firm, a management consulting firm that traditionally has delivered services using arms and legs in a very customized, bespoke way. But they've developed some intellectual property. It could be a methodology. It could be a data set. It could be an algorithm that they want to put into software. And they'd like to bring that to market. But at their core, they're services companies. So they don't really have the capabilities or the mindset to do what we call productization and take a more kind of market-minded approach. So we help teach them a process to identify ideas and see whether or not those ideas can indeed be productized, and then develop a commercialization strategy for those ideas.
Ayesha, this may seem cliche-ish, but you hear this term that every company is now a technology company, and every company is moving in to some level of digital transformation. Do you have any insights broadly that you might share with companies that are going through the exact transformation you just described? That there are some common pitfalls that the CEO faces and she or he needs to be thoughtful of. Maybe it's even these three things are coming your way, so write them down and have a plan for how you're going to address them.
Yeah, so the first one is speed of operations and speed of movement. So especially when we're talking about technology, as everyone knows, Moore's Law, things are moving quite rapidly. And most organizations who are not what we call tech native tend to operate at a slower pace than a technology company. Part of that could be, especially in professional services, part of that could be a value placed on perfectionist or perfectionism. And so they move slower to get things perfect. Part of it could also be risk aversion. So they move slower, make decisions, take longer to make decisions because they want more information before making decisions. But whatever's at the root cause, they're just moving at a slower pace. And I'm sure, as you can discern, the problem with that is that you risk a couple of things. One, being lapped by competitors, but also you risk putting things out in the market without enough market feedback. So one of the things that we work very closely on with companies is trying to get them to do experimentation and test and learn at a much faster clip than what they've done previously, so that they can not only keep pace with technology, but they can get rapid market feedback and then iterate based on that market feedback. And that's just a different way of operating. It's very normal for tech companies to have strong cultures of experimentation, be very good at testing and learning. But non-tech companies, that's usually not in their DNA, and it's something that they have to learn. So that speed is one of the primary mistakes that we see. I think the other thing, Scott, is a lot of fear. And you know, I mentioned risk aversion, but we also see, especially with new product innovation, fear of cannibalization and self-disrupting themselves and their revenue streams. And having that fear hold them back from the inevitable investments and steps that they need to take in order to keep pace with changing customer needs and changing technology.
Ayesha, you also have experience in SaaS organizations. I'd love to have you, again, broadly sort of just, what are some inflection points that companies that may not be tech native that are either desiring to become a SaaS organization or have, and maybe there's been some pitfalls along the way. First of all, maybe you can level set all of our listeners and viewers on what is the SaaS model, why is that valuable, and then maybe you can just arbitrarily pick three or four inflection points where people either pivot up or have a pitfall, including those companies that have made a transition into SaaS, but need successfully-ish, but need to move that momentum forward. Broad question, carte blanche on your response.
So let me break it down to a couple of things. So first of all, hopefully SaaS, everyone knows software as a service. And the as a service business model is very attractive because you get more revenue visibility, you get recurring revenue. If it's software, your gross margins are better. So there are a lot of reasons why you want to might want to develop something that looks like a SaaS model. But most organizations, especially again, non-tech native, non-product organizations who kind of have this as a long-term goal, aren't going to sunset their existing business and completely pivot to a SaaS model. Usually what they're going to do is kind of ascend along a ladder that we see. And the first step in that ladder, kind of that first inflection point that you asked about, is simply what we call productized services. So again, let's say you're talking about an accounting firm and they want to standardize how they're doing audits. They want to tech enable. Well, they might use some of the new Gen AI tools that are out there to do that. They might create playbooks to further kind of standardize and structure how they do audits. They may move pricing away from time and materials pricing to value-based pricing for part of their audits. The experience from the client's side is still going to be the same. They're still going to be dealing with a partner from the firm, more junior associates, people. But the way that service is delivered by people will be more efficient because it's been standardized, because it's been tech enabled, and the pricing likely will look different because perhaps it's more packaged value-based pricing. So that's kind of the first inflection point. And the biggest mistake that we see there is this mistake of fear of adopting the technology. And we're seeing this especially very acutely in the past 12 to 18 months with generative AI and professionals not wanting to embrace the new technology and use it. And then the second mistake that we see is organizations not having clear conversations with their clients about how they are standardizing the delivery of services and how they're using technology. And I think this gets back to one of those kind of in your DNA things that I alluded to earlier, which is this notion that things have to be perfect before we show them to clients, or that we always have to be, let's say, the experts. Technology companies, tech native companies, are great at co-designing, co-developing, having things run through beta, have multiple releases. Their consumers are used to things being messy by design and being improved upon over time. But non-tech native companies, non-product native companies, again, that's a different way of operating. And so they may not have clear communications with their clients about where they are in that journey. And so that's a common mistake we see at that inflection point. Now, the next inflection point and step on the ladder is that then products as a service, or having something that is no longer delivered by people. And usually what we see is most organizations are not developing those products to sell them standalone or as a replacement to their core business, but instead they're going to bundle them with their existing core business, let's say, with their legal services or their consulting services or whatnot. And then the common mistake that we see there is not using the right measures to measure success of those products. And perhaps holding them to too high of a standard, expecting a return on investment earlier than you would typically see for a software product, and then shutting those down before they really have the time to grow. So that's a common mistake we see there.
Aisha, several years ago, I was invited to join a panel for a large multi-global company, and I was one of three people on the panel talking about going through a digital transformation, what that meant, the upsides and the downsides. And I was the CMO at the time of the Franklin Covey company, but I was not an expert in digital transformations by any stretch, right? And Franklin Covey went through a similar SaaS transformation enormously successfully over the last nearly decade, not without pitfalls, of course. And I called my friend Seth Godin, everybody knows Seth Godin, to ask Seth what he thought about the struggles that organizations faced when they transitioned into a technology company, if you will. And he had an interesting insight. He said he saw the biggest pitfall that companies went through was they'll hire very smart tech leaders, right? Whether it's in AI or automation, whatever it is, and they usually are siloed. And their genius and their wisdom and their boondoggle budgets, happen over on this wing. And he said the problem is they don't speak the language of business. That, you know, those that are in the C-suite speaking the language of business often don't speak the language of technology, and the same is true, and we know who wins. It's not the technology AI people from MIT, it's the CEO and her or his team. And he said, when they happen well, it's because they're embedded in the business units. They understand the go-to-market approach, the culture, the communication. They understand the money-making model. And I thought it was very smart of Seth to talk about, when you are going through a digital transformation, when you are productizing, make sure that the technology minds of your company, the CIO, the CTO, whatever it is, that their teams are working side by side throughout the organization, that they understand the real part of business and what the struggles are. You're nodding your head yes. Would you take that any further? You might say, yes, and. What are some other things that C-level people need to be thoughtful about as they're looking at embedding AI? We're going to talk more about that. Any sort of cautionary tales to say, be careful of this, because this is an obstacle you will face, and you can avoid it if you're just a little more judicious.
Yeah, I think the yes, and certainly I agree with Seth that having your tech staff, your product teams more embedded, having that existing business understanding, quite frankly, is just table stakes if you're going to do an organization-wide digital transformation. I think the and part is the leaders have to be prepared for the cultural change that is required, because this is a fundamentally different way of thinking how we create value. Rather than Aisha Armstrong creating value, it's intellectual property that's been created by a team of people, codified, hopefully protected. So kind of the emphasis on the individual changes, and that can be a significant cultural change. Like I mentioned before, the pace of operations, 99% of the time, needs to increase. And that can be very uncomfortable for people outside of the technology team. And that if the organization is going to increase the cadence at which it operates, that has to come from the top. And the C-level leaders need to be demonstrating that. Like I mentioned, the threshold for the amount of information that we require in order to make decisions also needs to change. How we perceive failures, experiments that don't turn out the way that we thought they would, that nullify our hypotheses, that needs to change. So it is a significant cultural change. The technology, quite frankly, Scott, is easy. What's not easy is getting people to change behavior and how to start getting the organization to act more like a technology organization.
Beautifully said. Yesterday, I had the privilege of interviewing Tom Bilyeu, who is, of course, the famed entrepreneur and podcaster, sort of a tech-forward thinker. I mean, 1,000 episodes of his podcast. He's interviewed anybody and everybody in the world, probably one of the highest-rated podcasts in the world. And I asked him about the future of AI, right? And I said, I was interviewing a CHRO recently, Anita Grantham, and she said something pithy and wise. In the short term, at least, AI isn't going to take your job. But the person who uses AI effectively will probably take your job. And I'd love to have you opine on what do you see the next tranches of AI looking like in terms of cultural transformation, digital transformation, job displacement. And stop there for a second, because in my day job, I'm a literary agent. So I help people bring their books to life, and a speaking and talent agent. And I have a high net worth tech entrepreneur under representation, and he's writing a book about AI. And there's a dark side of AI coming. I mean, and I don't even know that everybody understands it. He wrote his book in a way that requires a pretty sophisticated knowledge of AI. And I said to him, I don't think the vast majority of people even know what AI is. Everybody can talk about it for 45 seconds, but no one can talk about it much longer than that. Would you, to the extent you have expertise on this or knowledge, would you maybe just riff on what's coming with AI? What should people in the C-suite know? What should people one level down or two levels down know about how they should accelerate their knowledge? Tom Bilyeu said everybody should spend 20 minutes a day on X or on YouTube, finding someone and watching and learning 20 minutes every day. And he said, in 2 years, you will be level set ready to have those skills in whatever role you're in. Take that anywhere you'd like to go.
Yeah, I completely agree with his recommendation. In fact, what I've been saying is an hour a day for most of the leaders that I work with. And it's because, again, we're in particularly working with professional services firms. And I think finally with AI, we have a technology that is going to disrupt professional services, white collar knowledge management work in a way that they've never been disrupted, ever. And again, this is not just my opinion. I mean, there have been economists who've done studies in the past year looking at, breaking down the tasks of these workers and everything from legal, accounting, architecture, IT applications development. We are talking 50, 60, 70% of tasks can be automated now, today. And we have clients who have GitHub's Copilot doing 85% of their computer programming. Okay, so the implications of that are quite significant. And I think the first one is, to the point that you just made, things are evolving very rapidly. And leaders will not be in a good position to make decisions about these investments, which, by the way, are incredibly expensive, nor will they be able to make good decisions about workforce planning, which they will need to start making, if they're not familiar with the technology. So that means that they need to be in there, not just learning about it, but using it in their own day-to-day work. And so that's why I say an hour, because it's not just about learning about the tools, it's like actually using them yourself in your professional life and in your personal life. The second thing that I think is important is also what you said, that we can't come from this from a place of fear. If we start talking about the amount of headcount that we can now reduce because of efficiencies, we are missing out on the true opportunity, which is what new customer problems can we solve as a result of having better data, better capabilities to do analysis, which AI brings us, but also having more time to do the things that are uniquely human. So I've been trying to shift the conversation with leaders away from, the fear-based efficiency use cases, and instead talk about the growth use cases and what are the new problems that we can solve as an organization because of this technology.
Aisha, I'm riveted listening to you. Would you be willing to get a little more prescriptive? If you were speaking to, say, the CEO of a professional services company, maybe they've made a SaaS transition, it's going well, and they recognize that AI is going to fundamentally destroy or strip or grow their organization based on their ability to lead out, ask the right questions, hire the right people, make the right partnerships. Are there some podcasts or books or thought leaders that you yourself have great respect for to say, hey, go to X and listen to this person, read this, watch that? Anybody that you've used to educate yourself as well?
Well, certainly AWS right now has phenomenal free training for anyone that is using AWS. So that's one place that I'm recommending people go for training, especially when it comes to just better understanding how these large language models work and more basic things like good prompt writing, for example. But rather than suggesting a specific thought leader or place for training. Again, my thing has been, what tools has your firm already invested in, and are you using them? And you would be surprised, Scott, at how many executives are not using the tools that their firms have spent, in some cases millions of dollars, and have told their professionals they need to start using. They're not using them themselves.
You and I share something in common. It's not intellect, but we are parents of sons. I believe you have two sons, and my wife and I have three sons. Our sons are 9, 13, and 14-ish, just turning 13, just turning 14. What advice do you have for parents of kids like ours, age of ours, that they need to have skills that are highly relevant 8, 10 years from now, right? 10 years from now, my youngest will be entering college. What that will look like, I have no idea. 8 years from now, my oldest son will be hopefully graduating from college if he chooses that path, and in the workforce. Whether they are barbers or orthopedic surgeons or massage therapists or coders or you name it, are there some skills that you see my three boys and your two sons are going to need 8 to 10 years from now that as parents we can start grooming and shepherding so that they're ready to compete in what will be an unrecognizable marketplace?
Yeah, I think the first one, and this is nothing new, is just the ability to learn. So I was having a debate with my sister-in-law yesterday because my oldest is going off to college and has chosen a small liberal arts college where they will get a degree in humanities. They actually don't have majors at the college that they have chosen to attend. And I was saying, I think this is good because I have no idea what skills we'll need even 3 years from now. And so my hope is that both my children become really good at learning and at critically thinking. So that would be the first one. And again, I'm not saying anything, you know, that educators have not been talking about for the past 20 to 30 years, but I do think in today's environment and with how quickly things are shifting, especially because of AI, the ability to learn quickly and think critically is important. The second skill set, and this is what I talk about with leaders when they start thinking about workforce planning in the context of AI, is that you still need people who have context. And so I do think there is value in going deep in different domains, not so much so that you can do the work yourself, but more that you understand how the work is being done and you can contextualize it. So let's say in the case of, again, accounting firms who are now using Gen AI to automate 60 to 70% of their audits. They still need a partner or senior associate who has context about the client in order to double check the work. And so how is that person going to develop context? Well, they're still going to develop it by going deep on, in different domains. So I do think that is of value. And then the last thing I'll say is emotional regulation. And I think that's an area where parents in particular can play a very strong role. So in my free time, I am also a part-time yoga instructor. And I tell people that yoga has completely transformed how I lead. And it's really helped me with emotional regulation. So when I'm in times of unpredictability, or perhaps when I'm having to make a decision with less than perfect information, or perhaps I'm afraid because of the pace of change or because of potential disruption, having a practice that helps you regulate your emotions, get back to your center, focus on the bigger picture, to me, that's invaluable, and I think that is a primary role for parents to play.
That was beautifully said. As the father of three boys, emotional regulation at my own level is probably the biggest contributor to my marriage or destroyer of my relationship with my wife. Okay, last question, Aisha. CEOs, CFOs, CMOs, COOs, CROs, CHROs, what are the skills they need? What is it you think, that, beyond AI and all of that, what are the skills you think that people that are in the C-suite or ascending to the C-suite need to be learning and mastering in the next couple of years to be relevant?
Yeah, I think one of the ones that I...
Learning, emotional regulation.
Yeah, things that I haven't mentioned all already, and I'll just go back to kind of, you know, where we started, which was my own story. One of the things that helped me immensely was the ability to build teams. And again, you know, I'm sure you'd have had many leaders on this podcast talk about that, but the ability to see the gifts in other people, assemble those gifts into a high-functioning team, get them to collaborate well with each other, because again, you know, technology companies are really good at collaboration as opposed to individual heroics. I think that ability to put teams together and to lead teams to do things that they couldn't do as individuals is certainly a big part of my own story and something that leaders need.
Aisha, send us off. How do organizations partner with your company? Where do they start? My invitation to let you talk a bit about your organization.
Oh, thank you. So one thing I'd recommend is I have a book called Productize. So if you're interested in learning more about that, that book is available wherever books are sold. And second would be LinkedIn. So I love to connect with readers, with other leaders. Feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.
Aisha Armstrong, great conversation. I can assure you I'll be sending this to everybody at Franklin Covey's C-Suite, and no doubt you'll see some of them connect with you on LinkedIn as well. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation from the C-Suite.